Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's May 19th. Currently, we've got 51 degrees here in Old Town Park City. We've got mostly sunny skies here and looking for a high today of about 68. Breezy conditions once again as we see kind of a cold front just outside our borders. Looking for a slight chance of a shower tonight between 7 p.m. and 1 a.m. Otherwise, partly cloudy, dropping down to a low of 36, just a 20% chance of some rain. Rain likely after 7 a.m. tomorrow with... they've even got a snow forecast in here. I'm guessing in the upper elevations. Looking for a high tomorrow of about 52. Showers and unsettled weather through Thursday, even lingering into Friday, with temperatures remaining into the 50s. 8:07 now. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Summit County Councilmember Tom Fisher. Later on in the hour, Recycle Utah Director Carolyn Moore in with an update on some of the operational changes there at the center. And finally, Park City resident Linda Dugan's organizing a Cowbells for Courage event to help celebrate all of those who are on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned. Well, a resort on the south side of the Jordanelle Reservoir featuring RV sites, glamping, and cabins took a step closer to approval last week. KPCW's David Boyle has more about that.
Wasatch County Planning Commission forwarded a favorable recommendation regarding approval of a master plan for Cove Point Resort at their meeting Thursday evening. The nearly 120-acre area is located on the southern end of the Jordanelle Reservoir on the north side of Highway 35 and just east of the Sorenson annexation. The proposed resort would have 89 RV spaces, 20 small cabins, 40 glamping sites, a restaurant, conference center, and storage units. Planning Commissioner Mark Hendricks expressed his support of the proposal.
I think this is a good idea for the county, the broader community, this type of use. I think the location is great for that. Generally, specifically, the details need to be worked out, but I'm very supportive of this.
While the Planning Commission did unanimously recommend approval to the County Council, they did have some concerns that they wanted addressed. One was the fact that the resort did not yet have plans to fill a requirement to connect to public trails. Paul Berg, representing the applicant, explained their current issue with that request.
One of the reasons that we didn't show other trails is we had reviewed the Sorenson master plan to the west of us, which just shows that area is open space, so we knew there wasn't any development that we needed to connect into. North of us is property associated with the Jordanelle Reservoir, so that didn't really leave us with anywhere to connect to, but we'll work with staff to see what we need to do to bring it in compliance.
Another issue raised by the Planning Commission was regarding future patrons' likely desire to access the lake from the resort. Berg says they'll work with Jordanelle State Park on the issue.
Sometimes the state park says, hey, we want you to enter at a controlled access, so one of their boat ramps or one of their other places. I think that's the only thing we'd have to work out is if they would allow us to build a path through their property to get to the lake. Otherwise, they usually want them to go through a controlled access.
If users are unable to access the reservoir from the resort, the commission recommended signage to prevent patrons from wandering down to the water's edge. Berg also said they'll be asking the Wasatch County Council to approve 5 employee housing units on site.
That will allow for our glamping operator, our conference center and restaurant operator, and then to have 3 employee housing units for the RV park, one for each 8-hour shift. If they approve that, then that shapes our affordable housing strategy. If they cut those number of units back, then that will also influence our strategy. But once we have their decision, it will help us to put a plan together for preliminary.
While all amenities would be open during the summer, glamping would not be available during winter. Using other RV campgrounds as a reference, they expect to be at 25% capacity during winters. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
8:11 now on this Tuesday morning. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Hey, a reminder that we've got the roundabout closed there at Jeremy Ranch for paving, final paving and striping today. You will need to use Rasmussen Road to get in and out of that area. Also at 8:30, the Historic Park City Alliance is holding their monthly meeting. You can find that Zoom link on our website, kpcw.org. And at 4 o'clock, the Park City Board of Education is scheduled to meet. You'll need to go onto their website, pcschools.us, to find a link to listen in to the streaming there live. And they're always a challenge to hear that. Anyway, we got 8:12 now, and the Summit County Council has a meeting scheduled every day this week, at least according to the website. On the phone with a preview of Wednesday's meeting, I have County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So Monday, Monday and Tuesday were closed door sessions. Thursday and Friday's all saying about security. Is that just to schedule the session in the event that the council needs to meet, or?
Well, we have actually been meeting practically every day since this emergency began, just to review statistics and plan for the next day, because something has changed with this practically every day with the state. So we keep having to try to keep up with that, as well as plan for the next health order. For instance, our current health order will end this Friday, and so we're trying to figure out how the state's going to move, what our data tells us, what we should be doing, and meld those into the next order. It is likely, as you've already reported, that Summit County will be moving into the yellow risk or low risk category.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. And just back to the agendas, though, is that kind of just like a placeholder, if you will, to schedule meetings?
Yeah, I mean, we need to consult with the council each day on these types of issues, because there's different types of issues that come up with these health orders. That can't be, that can be covered under a security closed session. So we do put those on the agenda every day.
All right. So do you expect to have a new order then by the end of the week that would actually go into effect, I guess, midnight Friday?
So as of our meeting yesterday afternoon, we were planning on getting a new health order lined up for discussion and possible adoption by the council on Wednesday. Stay tuned today. We're planning on amending that into the agenda this morning.
So is the council being pressured by the state or local businesses to move into the yellow zone, or this is just all part of the state plan?
The state has been very good. The governor's office has been very good about working directly with our health department in order to examine data. And right now, as Rich Bulla has been projecting, our data looks really good. Our county has done a very good job at slowing the spread of COVID. And of course, we're seeing a lot more recoveries than we're seeing new cases. So not wanting to speak for Rich, and of course, he'll represent this at some point today. I believe he will say that the data is looking good, and he is supportive of moving to low risk. But at the same time, we're trying to coordinate this with other government entities, and that's an important part too. Wasatch County was held in orange. We were held in orange during this week, and then Salt Lake City and several cities in the valley also were held in orange. So we're trying to coordinate all that. It hopefully makes it less confusing to the public and business. We are coordinated, and that's what we're trying to achieve this week.
Yeah, and we've certainly seen instances of cases increasing in other places, yet no one's pushing back to go back to that orange phase, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the sometimes you want local control and sometimes you don't. But the laws are set up one way. So different local governments get to look at this in different ways under our system. So that's probably mostly what you're seeing.
Okay. Wednesday's regular meeting starting at 4:30. At 4:35, the council will get its first look at the recommendations from the Restaurant Tax Committee. $2.9 million in funds, with 47 applicants asking for $4.9 million in projects. This money is from the collection of 1% that's tacked on to all restaurant meals. And when is that? Is it January 1 to December 31 of 2019 then?
As far as the collections of the money,
right?
Yes, it was 2019. The $2.9 million represents collections from our fiscal year 2019.
Okay, and again, so we're talking about almost $3 million in funds. What are we predicting that this is going to go down to a year from now?
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a real interesting question. I don't know. I think we're going to see a significant decrease in that. And we're going to have to project that into our next budget. Really a weird year and a tough year for the Restaurant Tax Committee and the council, to be dealing with, a program that really benefits everybody in the county, as we promote our restaurants and try and get more activity within our county. But, you know, this process started in March with the applications and then into April with the review of all this. And, you know, because of this, the nature of this emergency, the word on the street through this whole process was a lot less activity for the year. So this committee really had to keep their nose straight on how to approach this. And the advice at the time was, keep on with the same philosophy that you've always worked with this money with, and present a sound group of recommendations to the council. And then a discussion is going to have to happen because, some of these events that are supported by this tax are going to happen. Some of them aren't. We're going to have to deal with that throughout the year. And it may seem like we're sending kind of a mixed message where we're funding activities out in the community, that draw visitors in, at the same time that we're trying to deal with this emergency and prevent spread of a virus. So it's going to be a constant.
I'm sorry, you're kind of cutting out there, Tom.
Communication with the folks in order to make sure that they're used correctly. They're still supporting the organization that we want to see these organizations. And then if they can't be used, how do they get brought back into this pot of money so that they can be granted again in a future year?
Right. Yeah. That's exactly my question. It's like I thought that we really didn't want to bring in a lot of out-of-town guests right now, but the whole purpose of this is to get overnight visitors and guests into the restaurants, and especially those from outside of the county. So should the criteria be for funding be different this year or next?
Well, the hard part is that, the criteria is fairly strict to begin with, as far as this kind of tax and what it can be used for. So we have to, that's kind of the baseline criteria for it. And then, of course, there's things that are more near and dear to the county and the restaurants that they want to project. I think it's just going to have to be an ongoing conversation, because our situation today with this emergency is so volatile. We're going to have to be a little bit more nimble with this tax, certainly, and the grants, certainly within the guise of what they can be spent on. But there may be even some possibilities of, if an organization can't spend the money this year, but plan to do the same event next year when there may be less restrictions, perhaps a deadline could be extended in order to make that happen, especially when we expect revenues to be a lot less next year and we might want to spark some more activity next year. So I think we're going to be having those discussions. I think the council is going to have a healthy discussion with the committee leadership tomorrow around these recommendations. And it's a tough one. I don't know exactly what the right answer here is on this one yet.
Yeah, right. And again, right now, I mean, a number of events are proposed for funding, and we're not even sure that these events can happen. So if the event doesn't happen right now, it says that the money has to be returned. Are you telling me then that maybe what they do is just need to hold on to it, and that's kind of their grant for next year instead?
It's a possibility. We're going to have to evaluate that within the ordinance of this tax and within the state law that governs this to see if the council has that flexibility. I'm sure we're going to hear the council ask questions like that tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, one of the biggest chunks of change for this is $420,000 for the Restaurant Association to promote restaurants, again, which is hard to do when they're not open. So,
right. But, you know, you look at it on the opposite end, and from the restaurant perspective or the association or the individual restaurant perspective, you know, we've got thousands of employees that are supported by the restaurants in our community. And if there's any possibility that they're going to have any level of business activity this year, you know, the restaurant tax is around to support that. So that's going to be that balance between what we're trying to accomplish with our health orders and what kind of business activity there's going to be. You know, we are, and you know, it's interesting that we're also having a discussion with the Chamber of Commerce about marketing on our agenda tomorrow, which is going to be a very similar conversation about what kind of marketing goes on under a health emergency and what kind of audience that we're trying to target.
Right. Because I just wanted to mention, too, that another big chunk of change, $400,000, is for this Fly Free program for the Lodging Association. And again, I mean, it just seems so confusing. It's like, get as many people here as possible. Eventually, I guess.
You're absolutely right. And that's the mixed message that we're that obviously we're going to be discussing. You know, the idea that at the same time we're trying to pull a lot of people in from other places and still fight this emerging threat seems incongruent. But, you know, a lot of these traditional ways that we've done business and granted to under the restaurant tax, you know, haven't had the opportunity over the last 2 months to react to that yet. So I think we're going to have ongoing conversations about this as this grant money gets put out to the community in order to make sure that we're doing things holistically and supporting everything that we want to accomplish. There's going to be a level of business activity and there's still going to be restrictions on. And that ongoing balance is going to have to be dealt with within the restaurant tax recommendations as well. It hits practically everything we do.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, a presentation by Chamber Director Bill Malone, that'll be happening at 5 o'clock, I believe, the last agenda I looked at. And it's basically for the COVID-19 marketing re-engagement strategy. So he's come up with a plan, or is he looking for money to do it?
No, he's not coming up. I mean, he's not asking for any additional money. You know, the chamber already gets funded out of another one of our taxes, the transient room tax, and they have the budget to do what they're talking about. It's really a public discussion wanting to happen about how marketing happens. You know, like I said, we have businesses reopening, and they support the transient room tax, and they expect some level of marketing to support their business activity. So it's very important right now that the chamber and the county council and the public have some discussion about how that happens. Because we don't want to be incongruent with our what we're trying to have happen on the health side as well. So it's just a conversation that needs to happen before. Well before the chamber gets into that marketing phase for the summer and the fall.
Yeah. Apparently a study was done showing kind of a travel sentiment study. And basically what it shows is that people are going to start doing more road trips and that non-team outdoor recreation are the safest types of travel activity. So it sounds like there's some hope here. given that people will want to travel closer to home and want to go to places that can offer an abundance of outdoor activities. So I guess this is, there's some good news there?
Well, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of whether we're attractive or not, I think from that information that Bill Malone put in that presentation, I believe that we're going to be an attractive place. And, you know, we're used to being an attractive place. So then the discussion gets to how attractive do you want to be when you're also trying to keep people safe from a pandemic. So I believe that's what you'll hear the discussion about tomorrow. But, you know, I think the interesting part of reading through Bill's materials is that he has some very, and his organization has some very targeted ways to look at some of the places that might be hotspots around our region, around the West, to actually avoid that from a marketing perspective and really attract people from places that might be a little safer. But, you know, at the same time, we have to balance that.
Exactly. And when do we tell people that it's safe to come here?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and it also matters what the state is saying. And since the whole state after this week is likely to be in the low risk or yellow category, I think you're going to see statewide level marketing start to happen around some tourism. So, you know, they're looking at that balance too, and perhaps that provides some instruction as well.
And how important is it that the resorts open in as part of all of this? We haven't heard a whole lot about that happening.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't want to speak for the resorts. They certainly have their own plans, and we're hearing a little bit about that, and I think we're going to hear more over the next couple of weeks. You know, we have several big, large business segments. We have restaurants, we have lodging, we have resort. From the standpoint of activities for people to do. And, you know, at some point, I think they're going to want to open. And so we're going to be having to work closely with them from a health perspective on how to do that, because they're going to have to manage gatherings. They're going to have to manage how to keep people and large groups safe as they navigate different activities that they do in order to stay active in the summer. And I'm sure they have plans for that, because they have a lot riding on that as well.
Okay, a couple of things I wanted to get to quickly here. Let's see, there is a public survey around State Route 224. What's that about?
Yeah, so if people want to, you can go on our the county's website, and we are in conjunction with UDOT. Conducting UDOT, Park City, and the Federal Transit Administration, we are conducting a study about the interchange area around Kimball Junction. So the interchange and the two roads that cross it, cross 224 with signals, and the whole signal system there, kind of under the ideas that were generated around the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan. This is all part of a process to line up to eventually do some major highway work around that interchange. So in order to get out in front of a project and start to get to the point where we design a project that will help relieve some of the traffic congestion and choke points that we have in Kimball Junction that make it operate at less than optimal, we have to start these studies now, and we've been doing them up until this point, and we're continuing that process. So there is a survey out available on the county website and through UDOT on the project website for 224. And they want to hear from the public. This is open from until June 1st. I've gotten on there and done the survey myself. It's pretty quick, less than 5 minutes. Just to start the process of some public input on what they would like to see in different types of transportation. You'll recall that we had some pedestrian type crossings in the neighborhood plan across 224. It's asking questions about those types of mode, plus the car, plus transit.
All right. And that, talk to me a little bit about the face coverings. These are all required now in Summit County facilities?
Yeah. So an internal policy, you know, this is not anything within the health order. This is Summit County's policy that I've put in place. In an effort to really make sure that we keep our business lines open, the example I can give is our license plate renewal service. We have about four people that provide that service. We're providing it at Kimball Junction in the offices we have there. We are requiring patrons who visit county buildings to wear face masks. And I know that's a controversial subject. You know, people want to be able to make their own choices there. But, you know, it's certainly to protect people, the public, from each other, as social distancing might be challenging in some cases. But if we lose one of those people that provide that service in a very tight space, we're probably going to lose all of them at once. So I want to be able to keep that service open to the public. It's a necessary service. So we're asking people, more than asking, we're expecting people to wear masks within our buildings. And you'll see our staff wearing masks too, unless they're behind a plexiglass cover or something like that that protects them. But really, in a lot of our services, we can't lose too many people before that service becomes ineffective. So I'm trying to preserve the workforce there.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Hey, Tom, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Carolyn Warren with Recycle Utah right after this. Well, operations are changing just a bit at Recycle Utah. On the phone with an update, I have the Executive Director of Recycle Utah, Carolyn Warren. Good morning to you, Carolyn.
Good morning, Leslie.
Okay. So what are we doing differently here now that we're kind of moving back from some of the restrictions?
Yeah, perfect. I want to start off with a thank you to KPCW, first of all. I think we're kind of in an ever-changing environment as a community, and things are changing. You know, I just heard Tom on the radio from going from orange to yellow, and I think a lot of things are changing. Recycle Utah is one of them, and I think the radio station's done a really great job getting the word out, so thank you for that. And into Recycle Utah, we are now open during the daytime. We open up at 10 a.m., and we allow five cars in at a time, and the community has been really good about managing that. You have to pull up and you count the cars, and there's five. Just wait and wait for a spot to open up. We feel that the five-car limit kind of gives everybody the space they need to get the recycling done, and it's not too crowded in here. It's been working out really well. We've been doing this for about a week and a half now. So.
Okay. And if there are more than five cars, what, people just need to sit in their car and wait?
Yep, just wait in your car. We recommend that you don't idle. You know, be a little earth-friendly coming to the recycle center. And then we can always help out each other by doing some pre-sorting at home. Maybe before you load up your car, make sure, you know, you have a bin that all the glass is in, a bin that all the plastic is in. We find that the slowest recycling happens when the bin is mixed and you're walking, you know, to the cardboard, and then to the plastic, and then to glass, and then back to plastic. So we kind of just pre-sort your stuff, come to the center with everything to be as quick as in and out as you can. And then we do have our thrift store open. It's our warehouse. If you plan to come shop for a long time, we maybe ask that you park off-site and walk in. You can park in the neighboring parking lots and just come in quick, or make your shopping quick to be in and out. Overall, we've been doing this for about a week and a half, and it's working pretty well. Five cars seems to be a good, safe limit to give everybody space, and nobody has to wait too long in line. So.
Okay. You are asking people to wear masks, but they're not required.
Right. Yep. We're recommending people wear a mask, and then be kind of just cognizant of areas that are kind of small, like the plastic tent's pretty small. We've seen people wait outside until one person inside is done. And then the area that uses glass recycling is kind of small as well. So if you're using one of those small places, just give someone some space there. And our staff here will all be wearing masks when they're working outside. So.
Okay. And then in terms of people purchasing things, do they need to have a debit card or a credit card or something, or you'll take cash?
We'll take cash. We've always kind of been a cash, like a drop buck location. So we do take cash. We have everything in place to keep employees' hands clean and sanitized after touching cash. But cash has kind of been something we've always done here. So.
Okay. And people should know that you are closed next Monday.
Yes, we're closed for Memorial Day. We've stayed open every day through this whole thing. We've kind of changed our hours a lot, and our staff is kind of looking forward to a day off that we can close the center and take a day all to spend some time recovering a little bit. So the that means the center is completely closed. It's blocked off. We really ask the community to hold on the recycling for that day and also take the day off as well.
Okay, dumpster days, they're coming up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we are going to host dumpster days. That will happen next weekend, the next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. That's May 28th, 29th, and 30th. And that's a normal event we kind of do in the spring. There's two dumpsters outside. One is for large household waste, and one is for yard waste. Household waste can't include anything like mattresses, hazardous waste, anything of that sort. It's kind of just for something too large for a curbside bin. So maybe think of a broken picnic table or a broken chair, a dresser or something like that that is hard to get rid of there. And then yard waste, just green clippings from your yard, maybe some branches, type stuff like that. We don't accept any construction waste. And we often see a lot of local landscapers trying to come into this event. We can tell the big difference between a landscaper and a normal household, so we ask that the landscapers don't come, and if they do come, we will send you away. We're really asking the social distancing practices that you bring someone from your household to help you lift waste into the bin. We don't want any of our volunteers getting too close to each other during this. And then we do dumpster days at the end of June, again, if you're not able to get everything in order, the last Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in June. I think that's the 25th through 27th. And, don't forget to drop a donation when you come. It does cost us to hold this event, and we're going to stay loyal to the community and host this event during this time.
Okay. Let's see. How did your Earth Day celebration go, your drive-by?
It went pretty well. It was so nice to see people. I think through this whole thing, I realized how much I missed the hustle and bustle of people coming in the recycle center and got kind of quiet here. And a lot of people stopped by and waved to us from afar, and that was nice. And we had an Earth Day silent auction that did better than we expected. We're really grateful for this community for stepping up to all the nonprofits in town. I think the community connection is strong here right now, and I think we're really seeing how strong we are as a community getting through this.
All right. What about any news on the Hazardous Household Collection Day?
We weren't able to do our spring one, and we worked with Summit County, and we decided not to reschedule that. So we will be pushing ahead to the fall collection event, which is scheduled for, I think it's September 25th. And if someone does have something that they have questions about getting rid of, the Summit County landfill is an option. They take hazardous waste at no charge for Summit County residents, and they do dispose of it properly. They have a hazardous waste section there. I think people get confused sometimes with bringing hazardous waste to the landfill, but they do handle it properly, and they have a separate section for all that kind of thing, and they do take it for free. If someone has questions about anything, I'm totally encouraging people to give us a call. We're on the phone a lot during the day trying to answer questions about disposing of things right, and given the funky situation we're in, we just want to make sure that it gets handled properly.
Okay. As we've been reporting, Summit County is considering a new request for proposal for a new garbage contract bid. Is that something that Recycle Utah would be part of?
Not necessarily. We've been providing guidance, kind of recommendations. I've seen the facilities this type of stuff goes to, and I kind of have a overview of how it works. And we've worked with them in terms of, where curbside recycling leaves off. You can't put any glass, styrofoam, or plastic bags in your curbside bin, and those are all things we accept here. So I see both programs working in tandem together, and I don't think that will change. I think it's just a matter of supporting Summit County into finding the right options for that program moving forward.
Yeah. Anything that Recycle Utah would like to see in a new RFP?
I definitely want to see curbside recycling continue, and I think there's a way to make that work. I think sometimes the conversation could get kind of negative with where it's going and where markets are at. But recycling, it's kind of like the stock market. It's always an ever-changing thing, and to let today's recycling market discontinue a program would be the wrong decision. I think that we need to look at it as a long-term goal, and there's always, I think there could be education improved with whatever new program we adopt. I think we could do a better job of educating how the curbside program works and how to best use it properly. And that would bring down our contamination and our loads and ultimately get more things recycled. And I think there's room for improvement there. And I think Recycle Utah is really interested in helping Summit County or whoever the new contract holder increase education in our community there.
Okay. And then anything to update on a new recycling center? Have you guys closed on a location or anything like that?
We've been working on some things, but I'm not able to talk about them at this point. So I feel optimistic about the situation. Again, COVID did slow things down, but optimistic overall, and I should have something to say in the future.
Okay. Carolyn, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, thank you again to the community. Thanks for supporting us through this time and continuing to recycle. And KPCB has been great about getting us through all these changes in our town.
Great. Well, happy to help. Thank you.
Thanks. Yep.
Executive Director of Recycle Utah, Carolyn Warr. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, 70% of Midway residents polled wish to have a new large transmission lines buried underground, and over $500,000 has been raised to fund that effort. KPCW's David Boyle reports that despite that effort, the lines will likely go overhead due to the high cost and a large power company's reported deadline.
In December, Midway City Council unanimously voted to approve the joint conditional use permit submitted by Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power to construct new transmission lines to carry power throughout the southern portion of Midway. The approval was conditional on a few items, the key one being that the lines be buried if Midway can secure the funds to pay for the additional cost. A few months later, Rocky Mountain Power provided three bids for the cost to bury the lines in Midway, the lowest being $12.6 million. The power company also challenged the conditions on their permit to the Utah Utility Facility Review Board, a state entity that resolves dispute between local governments and power companies. Midway City argued to the board that the bids accepted by Rocky Mountain Power contained mistakes and were too high. Additionally, Midway argued that they should be given time to pass a bond in November to pay for the cost to bury the lines. After hours of hearings, the board ruled in favor of Rocky Mountain Power. At this Tuesday's meeting, Midway City Council will consider appealing the ruling by the board. If the council chooses not to appeal the ruling, they will have to vote Tuesday evening whether to agree to pay to bury the lines within the next 120 days in an amount exceeding $12 million. City officials and staff have previously stated they do not have anywhere near that amount of liquid cash on hand. Alternatively, the city will vote to agree to have the lines go overhead. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Well, the Heber City Council will be voting on and likely approving a petition known as the Sorensen Annexation at their meeting tonight. This agreement will double the size of Heber, the 5,700-unit development on 8,000 acres to the north of the current Heber City boundaries was originally approved by a previous Wasatch County Council. Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter says that it's within the city and the developer's best interest to have urban development take place within a municipality.
Cities are designed for urban development. We have better processes, and then people have to pay municipal taxes for the services they receive. If they are in an unincorporated part of the county, we all pay for their services as county taxpayers. I feel like they should be paying municipal services if they're in urban densities. The other one is I think it's going to be a better development in the city. We've done a huge effort of planning, and they're going to benefit from that. We have better sign ordinances, dark sky ordinances, and I think it'll be a better development as part of Heber City.
Striking the deal between the two entities didn't have an impact on the earlier decided upon density. It did, however, result in a clustering of the development. The project will be made up of three village centers, one near the UVU campus, another near the southern end of the Jordan Reservoir, and the final in the Jordan Mountains. Clustering the development will leave some 5,000 of the project's 8,000 acres as open space.
It's anticipated that the open space will be dedicated to the city, so then the city will maintain the open space. The council is in conversations about how that will be funded and how that'll all work out still. The trail system that Sorensen has already built will stay, except with some of it being relocated and then added to. So we'll see a lot of what the trails are that people love and are already using will be maintained and stay the way they are.
The build-out will occur over 40 years, eventually doubling the size of Heber. Potter says the UVU and Lakeside Village Centers will have retail and mixed uses.
It's more accessible, less demand on the roads because people aren't having to all drive to Smith and Heber City. There will be places anticipated to meet all the needs on the north end of town.
10% or 570 units will be required to be affordable housing, and they will not be limited to a single location.
That's another requirement in the master development agreement is that they do not have it all in one area. It has to be spread throughout the different village centers, so it's not all one center of affordable housing.
During last week's meeting public comment session, one resident asked if it was wise for the city to lock the developer into current zoning laws for the next 40 years. Potter said it is common for master development agreements of this size to lock in zoning.
We're going to get a higher quality development if they have some predictability and they're not thinking, wow, we better withhold some cash because the city might change our road standards or they might require more of us. So if they know what's happening, we believe the quality of the development will be higher. And we also have in the development that if the developer agrees with the city, they will make changes as time moves on. They want to have the best development possible, as do we. Currently, they are agreeing to some changes we haven't even adopted yet on street standards. The council is looking to narrow some of our street requirements. requirements for less concrete and wider park strips, they're agreeing to those things even though we haven't adopted them yet.
The council, again, is finalizing the master development agreement to vote tonight. Final touches include pinning down some of the amenities provided at the parks, including parking. The Tuesday evening meeting is being conducted online due to COVID-19 restrictions. KPCW News Time now, 8:48. Although performances at Deer Valley's Snow Park Amphitheater have been canceled for the summer, the Utah Symphony is still planning on a jam-packed slate next year, and they're also providing music online in the interim. Interim CEO of Utah Symphony Opera, Patricia Richards, says that postponing the 2020 Summer Deer Valley Music Festival was an emotionally difficult decision, but an obvious one.
You just cannot have large crowds under these circumstances. And we fully support the county's position. Our first priority is the health and safety of our musicians, our staff, the guest artists that come in, and certainly the audience.
Although no performances will happen this summer season, the symphony is calling the cancellation a postponement, as most of the guest artists slated to perform this year will be back next summer, along with some additional performers. Richard says that they'll be announcing the lineup in the coming weeks.
So when we announce, we are going to be able to transfer everyone's tickets to next year. And we're actually saying, if for any reason that you can't come next year, please consider donating your tickets back. This situation is such a difficult one for all of the performing arts.
Revenues are down 50% due to cancellations for half of the season, with revenue covering just 30% of the cost of productions. Richard says that they're asking for extra consideration during this time. Thanks to loans for the Small Business Administration, the musicians are still being paid and even performing at home. You can watch those performances on the Utah Symphony website as well as its social media channels.
Some really wonderful productions that we are doing with part of the orchestra at a time, maybe 10 or 12 players working very widely spaced, but making these recordings for us to broadcast and stream.
Richard says you can also watch their programming celebrating their 80th anniversary this day, 80 years ago, of the Utah Symphony's first concert. KPCW News Time now, 8:51. Well, Main Street business owner Linda Dugans is a social distancing compliant community event that she's calling Cowbells for Courage. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Linda.
Hey, Leslie.
So tell us, what is Cowbells for Courage?
You know, it's an event that some of us are planning. We just feel like with the recent events, everyone's feeling a little helpless and sometimes hopeless, and we're hoping this event will change that. We are promoting a rolling parade, and what it will involve is people decorating their cars, getting out their cowbells, or perhaps even regular bells or pots and pans, and we're going to start at the Park City Hospital and visit some of our first-line workers.
Okay, so when is this happening?
It's happening this Thursday at 3 o'clock. We're gathering at the Quinn's Trailhead in Quinn's Junction, the one that's between the dog park and the ice rink. And we're actually going to be led by a Park City Police motorcade.
Okay. So, and then where are you guys traveling from there? You're going to drive by the hospital?
Absolutely. That's our starting place. We'll drive through the hospital, and we'll head down Round Valley Drive, and hopefully some of the employees at the Round Valley Clinic and the health department will be outside. We'll then head into town and do the little strip by the market in hopes that a lot of those employees will be out and we can kind of show our appreciation by honking horns and our decorated cars. Next, we'll head to the Park City Police Department, and the fire department should be there as well. We're not going to be able to do a drive-by at the actual fire departments. Then we'll head out to the junction and go by Smith's Marketplace and end up at Summit County Sheriff's Office.
Okay. And you expect that to take about an hour then?
That's kind of what we're thinking, depending on the amount of cars.
Okay. So why do you think that this is something important to do, be part of?
Well, we've all learned one big lesson, that community matters more than ever. And I think it's just a great time for us to connect and show appreciation for the people that have not stopped working. And they've worked on our behalf and, in many times put themselves in tough situations to serve the Park City community.
Okay. Again, decorate your car, stay in your car, bring your cowbells and plan on honking your horns. Again, meeting at the Quinns Junction Trailhead Thursday at 3:00. Anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, I think this would also be a great time for families with young children to get involved. The kids could make homemade posters and signs and, you know, decorate their cars with streamers. I think it's important for the adults to show appreciation right now, but I think it's great if we give our kids in Park City an opportunity to kind of thank those around us as well.
Okay, Linda, great idea. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
It's Linda Dugans again. Cowbells for Courage. Again, it's starting Thursday at 3:00. Plan to meet with your decorated car and cowbells there at the Quinns Junction Trailhead. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, when you think of all of life's essentials, water is right there at the top of the list. And when two positive cases of COVID-19 were reported at the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, longstanding protocols were changed to protect the staff of the two treatment plants to ensure that the rest of the staff could continue to do their jobs. Early on in the pandemic, a staff member of the district tested positive for COVID-19. He was asymptomatic and had spent a lot of time with his supervisor, who was later also tested positive. The district's general manager, Mike Lures, reported the situation to the Board of Trustees at their meeting last night. Lures tells KPCW because both employees were asymptomatic, they would have never known that the two employees were sick, and the two could have spread the virus even further. Fortunately, one of the employees had personal contact with someone who had traveled out of the country, and that person, who was also asymptomatic and positive, was tested when they arrived home.
As a result of that, we placed a number of employees in quarantine at home for 14 days, and thank goodness we haven't had any additional cases here at the district. As you well know, we do provide an essential service, so we've taken extensive actions to protect our skilled staff and the public, in particular our advanced water reclamation facilities are staffed with licensed operators, and we can't afford to have them come down with COVID-19.
Both staff members are okay and back to work, including the two employees who tested positive. Lures said that a total of six staff members were quarantined for 2 weeks. The quarantines didn't impact the work that needs to be done at the treatment plants, and he says it taught them some good lessons. He says they've taken some steps to ensure that if someone should become infected, the spread would be minimal.
We've really taken dramatic steps to keep our folks isolated because we cannot afford to, you know, obviously not operate the water treatment plants or the, what we call the water reclamation facilities. Number one, we used to rotate our shifts between the two plants. We don't do that anymore. And we require each person to work in isolation at the treatment plant. Now, some of our work requires removing heavy motors and equipment, and you can't do it as an individual. It takes two people. So we've paired work crews up where necessary into two-person crews, and they are, so to speak, married to each other for the duration of the pandemic.
Given the nature of the job, many of those on the front end of treatment must be well protected.
Wastewater contains COVID-19 virus, along with, you know, many other disease-causing bacteria and viruses. So we wear N95 masks, face shields, gloves, tieback suits for most of the work that we do. And it's just a continuation of what we've always done. We have ramped it up a little bit for the guys that are working in the field on cleaning the sewer lines. So, yes, they do wear the PPEs, and we've increased the usage of PPEs for the guys that maintain our sewer system.
And as he said, wastewater is full of contaminants with very dangerous substances.
Wastewater contains everything from, you know, it can contain HIV, you know, hepatitis, cholera, all of those type of things. So it's just protective measures that we have previously had in place to protect our employees that also protect employees for the SARS virus. So, no, the SARS didn't exist there, but it certainly exists there now.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I never realized this is a dangerous job.
It really is. Our guys get suited up when they have to two operations that they're exposed to all sewage, so they have to really be careful.
Lewis says there's no need to worry, though, that we're passing the virus off to those living downstream, and he wants to reassure the public that the district's two advanced treatment plants can remove the virus using ultraviolet technology.
The good news is we can completely knock out those viruses before that treated wastewater is put back into streams.
A second issue the district's had to deal with is the fact that there aren't people in town, and with the restaurants and hotels closed down, which are huge water consumers, the wastewater, he says, has less stuff in it, which has created a microbiological and chemical challenge.
We don't have enough wastewater to keep our microbiotic, the bugs that treat the wastewater, the microscopic bugs, alive. So we've had to take dramatic steps in dealing with that situation. Our new treatment plant over here behind Home Depot, we've shut half of it down because we don't have enough wastewater or enough poop to keep the bugs alive. To have to shut down a half of a treatment plant to keep the bugs alive is something we've never had to do before.
And because of the high number of per capita cases of COVID within the district's boundaries, he says the district is now part of a national study. Coming up now on 9 o'clock, stay tuned for NPR News. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.